Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
David is co-hosting today with David Stearns, president of Dale Carnegie, Maine.
This week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is going to be Nathan Warwicki from Sheehan Finney. He's a business immigration attorney, and he's going to start today part one of Immigration for Employment. We're going to have a great discussion today, so let's welcome our guest, Nathan Warwicki. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we're going to be speaking with Nathan Warwicki. He is with the law firm of Sheehan Finney, and he is a business immigration attorney. And today, we're going to be talking about the ever-popular, but yet more important, immigration laws that are happening here in the U.S. in regards to bringing employees from overseas into the United States. Nathan, thanks for joining our show.
Thanks, Dave, for having me.
No, it's great. It's great to have you. And, of course, Dave Stearns and I here this morning are excited to talk to you about this. This topic is becoming more and more important as the challenges happen with hiring here in the United States. With the lack of skilled workers, this continues to be a big issue. What is your firm seeing in regards to immigration and bringing employees into the United States? What trends are you seeing?
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of employers kind of make business decisions and make hiring decisions, and then because the law tells them to, or because it doesn't really enter their radar until later, then they get to the meat and potatoes of trying to figure out how to get someone to the United States. So if you have a company that has multiple locations across the world, relationships with, at least in our firm, we have a lot of companies with relationships in Europe, and we have companies here who need those skilled workers and end up turning to college university students for the help. So in many of those situations, immigration status comes up, and clients turn to us to try to solve the problem of getting someone a work visa.
So you're talking about bringing somebody into the United States in regards to working. Are there specific countries, let's start with the base here, are there specific countries in that it is more of a challenge, and are there differences from country to country, or is there a standard process that is across, you know, from bringing somebody in from almost any country?
Yeah, so the way that the immigration law works is there is a worldwide quota on immigrant visas, and just to back up a second, there's a big difference in immigration law between an immigrant visa and a non-immigrant visa. An immigrant visa is a permanent residence, and so that is a green card that everyone is probably familiar with. And a non-immigrant visa is a temporary visa, which is good for a number of years, but does ultimately expire and need renewal, or in some cases it can't be renewed any longer. So what we see is that because there's a worldwide quota on the immigrant visas, there's not a lot of challenges that are applicable to a certain nationality. The only exception with that is that in the immigrant realm, the immigration law has a per-country limitation, meaning that countries who have historically had the lion's share of immigrants to the United States, there's a per-country limitation piece of the law which says that we're not going to. So, for instance, India and China are two of the countries that historically have been the country of origin for many immigrants. The law now says that immigration from those countries is limited each year so that we have some more diversity in the number of the nationality of immigrants coming to the United States. So that's the main difference in terms of nationalities.
So it's not based upon skill set. It's based upon, in that particular case, the number of workers allowed into the United States from each country specifically.
That's part of the metric. The other part of the metric is, as you just said, the skills and the need of the employers. So again, going into the immigrant realm, the way that the visas are allotted, green cards are allotted, is based on a priority system. That priority system, which is five different priority preferences categories, they call them, starts with the first preference category, which is for your Oppenheimers and Einsteins and those types of folks who have extraordinary abilities, and also for outstanding researchers, and then for multinational executives. The second preference category is for your exceptional workers. So there's a difference between extraordinary and exceptional. And also in the second preference category, professionals with advanced degrees, meaning professionals with master's degrees. And in the third category, you have your skilled workers and also your unskilled workers. So that's folks who either have a bachelor's degree, skilled workers, or 2 years of experience, or unskilled workers who have less than 2 years. So that's one part of the metric matrix that's used, and the other part is the nationality, which creates some special challenges for companies who are looking for employees from India or China.
So there are really two parts of this equation, right? The country they're coming from, and the second is, do they fit within these categories that you just provided to us? And
right.
Obviously, we don't have time to get into each one of them specifically, but I would love to know the difference between extraordinary. It almost sounds like a flavor on a menu. But
great.
Yeah.
It's like a great question.
Great question. Great. What is the real difference between the two? Actually, what is the difference really between the two? I'm going to ask the question.
Sure. Well, for an extraordinary ability person, the first preference, they have to have a degree of notoriety and accomplishment which rises above what most people can document. And there's a regulatory scheme, a test that is established, which can help employers and employees figure out if they fit there. And the test just basically is either you have a Nobel Prize or you meet 3 of 10 criteria under the regulations. And those criteria range from commanding a very high salary in relation to everyone else, being recognized in major publications and news media articles, to being on a panel in national conferences and having perhaps even employment with a very distinguished employer in your past. So that's the test for the extraordinary. And for the exceptional, it's a lesser degree to that. You don't have to have a Nobel Prize and the exceptional aspect. Actually, most times folks who meet the exceptional test also have a master's degree. If you have a master's degree, then you fit with the second preference anyway. So that's the main difference.
So Nathan, I'm just curious, who does the testing? Who sets the rules? Who governs this whole thing?
Sure. Well, it's a joint administrative program which is run by the Department of Labor, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of State.
Wow.
And their roles in this are, the Department of Labor oversees the labor market testing, so they make sure that the immigration of folks for employment purposes does not have adverse effects on U.S. workers or the wages for U.S. workers. The Homeland Security Department actually adjudicates the petition, so they make the determination as to who's exceptional, who's skilled, who is extraordinary. And then the Department of State, which has the ministerial, so kind of the processing responsibilities, and actually making sure that the worldwide quota for immigration is not exceeded in any given year, and actually going about handing out visas to folks who are coming from abroad.
So, you know, Nathan, one of the things that might be helpful to the audience is to understand maybe some of the historical roots of how this came about. Can you kind of give a little overview in terms of that perspective, and then I guess we'll talk about today's laws and then talk about specifics and try to get some examples, if we could, for the audience in terms of if they're thinking of doing this, what would it look like?
Sure. Well, I think most people who think about immigration tend to think of Ellis Island and that kind of immigration system that really lasted up until the 1920s. Before 1920, the rules concerning immigration were very lax. For instance, most of the laws had to do with who could become a United States citizen, and that started with the birth of the Republic. And many people might remember from their history classes in high school, the Alien Sedition Acts. Maybe not. I don't know. I was a history major, so I remember those things. But that is one of the first examples of immigration law in the United States, and that controlled the ability of folks to be in the United States if their country of origin, the United States, were at war. That then developed over the next 150 years or so into very segmented regulation of immigrants based primarily on the country of origin. So the people might be familiar with the Chinese Exclusion Acts that were in the late 19th century. And also there were some regulation over people with contagious diseases. So again, getting back to that Ellis Island picture in your mind, someone shows up and they get a TB test by the inspection officer, and if they pass, then they get in. If not, they're sent back home. That system persisted until the 20s, and in the 20s, the Congress decided that it wanted to control the immigration of people to the United States based on where they were from. So there was a worldwide quota, and it assigned quotas to each country based on the ethnic makeup of the United States in the 1910 census. And that was the law up until the 50s and 60s, when that kind of gave way to a priority system based on skills, which people who are familiar with today's system are very aware of. And that skill-based system has steadily evolved from the Immigration Act of 1965 into what we have today.
So as we focus into today and looking at this quota system, tell me kind of where the current state of the law is. You kind of told us a little bit about that there's a number that's allowed per country for certain countries. Tell us a little bit some of the rules for, hey, I'm an employer and I'm thinking of bringing someone into the country. What laws do I need to know?
Yeah, well, the first one that most employers are probably familiar with anyway is that in 1986, Congress passed a law which said that you have to have employment authorization to work in the United States. And so many employers know about the Form I-9, and I'm sure everyone listening to this knows that as
famous
well.
Famous I-9.
Yes. So that is that's the manifestation of that law, and that applies to everyone. Every employer has to verify employment authorization. For a non-U.S. citizen, that typically employment authorization is typically conferred by either permanent residence in the United States, so a green card, or a visa for employment. So that's where most employers start. And then when you have someone who's not a United States citizen and needs sponsorship to get that employment authorization, then the employers start to go into what's the menu of options available to them. And, you know, we did talk about the immigrant visa system and the worldwide allotment of visas and the skills, the way that the skills preference categories are used. But most employers first turn to the non-immigrant visas in order to fill their needs for employees. And those non-immigrant visas are the letter visas that employers might be familiar with. So H is a big one, L, O's, P's, Q's. I mean, there's a whole alphabet soup of visas, and that's where a lot of our employers are looking for help to figure out which is the most appropriate category.
You mentioned sponsorship, so an organization or someone has to sponsor. Could you kind of get a little clarity on that, what that actually means? Does that mean that not only they sponsor, they're responsible for? How does that kind of work from a legal perspective?
What we're talking about today is employment-based immigration, and the sponsor is the employer, so the entity or the person that can be an individual or a legal entity like a corporation. They need an employee to do a job, and they initiate the visa process for the potential employee, the foreign person. And so that's why I talk about sponsorship. Sponsorship involves the filing of paperwork with the Immigration Service and some other federal agencies. And in many cases for non-immigrant visas, complying with the laws that govern that particular visa category over the course of the relationship. That sponsorship begins and ends with the filing of paperwork and then the employee's receipt of a green card. But there's not a lot of oversight over the employment relationship after the green card is received.
We're talking with Nathan Warrocky. He's with Sheehan Finney, and he is a business immigration attorney. And we're talking about employment immigration. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Not available in all states. Introducing the most exciting new franchise opportunity in years. Reese and Irvy's world's first frozen yogurt vending robot. The revolutionary high-tech first-of-its-kind approach to frozen yogurt franchising. These robots are a huge hit in malls, movie theaters, supermarkets, practically anywhere. If you're looking to start your own franchise and be the first in your market to unveil this exciting high-profit kiosk, find out how we can help you secure premium locations. Locations are going fast, so act now. Just go to froyofranchising.com. That's froyofranchising.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
Join the Northeast Human Resource Association at their annual conference from September 28th through 30th in Falmouth, Massachusetts. See why the NERA conference is sure to be 2.5 days of HR education you won't want to miss. With awesome keynotes, you'll be sure to leave Falmouth with new resources and key knowledge to support you in your career and earn up to 15.5 SHRM and HRCI credits. Register now at nehra.com or by calling 781-235-2900.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, myself, David Chulo, is your host, and our guest host is with me, David Stearns from Dale Carnegie, Maine. And we're talking with Nathan Warrocky. He is with Sheehan Finney, and he is a business immigration attorney. Nathan, how are you today?
Very good.
Awesome. Well, we're talking about taking and bringing employees in from other countries. That's what we're talking about today, immigration for employment. You mentioned in the first section that there is a whole alphabet soup of specific, I guess it is, visas, classifications that we're going to be talking about. So let's go down the alphabet today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about us, kind of give an example of each if you could, and that way the audience will know what may apply to them.
Sure. Well, you know, I think probably the place to start there is the B visa, not only because it's the beginning of the alphabet, but also because it's one of the most commonly used visas. And The B is the classification given to visitors to the United States. So if you're coming for pleasure or business for a limited period of time, you come on a B. And employers in the United States who have folks that they want to interview with or are engaging in negotiations with maybe a related company or a customer abroad, they typically use the B visa to help their associate come to the United States. And one of the examples I could think of in that situation is if you have a company, let's say in the United States and Canada, who has cross-border operations, and they need to kind of move people around for trainings on a short-term basis between jurisdictions, and they use the B visa because it's not labor-intensive at all. And it doesn't require any sort of filings, really, with the Immigration Service. So it's a good example of that. And it also doesn't have any sort of obligations for wages. It's not for employment. It's for visitors.
So just for visitors, you don't have to pay for them to come over. You don't have to do any of that. It's just straight, like, hey, you're coming in for a conference. You're coming in for some, you know, consultation, that type of thing.
Yeah, generally that's the case. Now, there are a lot of different kind of manifestations of what is permitted. And actually, in the Canada-U.S. example, NAFTA, which many people are probably familiar with, expanded the duties that Canadian citizens can perform in the United States as a visitor. So, for instance, truck drivers is one of those folks who have commercial trucks registered in Canada can come to the United States to continue deliveries from Canada to the United States using this particular visa. That's not permitted from any other countries, and that makes sense because, you know, we don't share borders with countries besides Canada and Mexico. So that's just an example of that.
Sure.
The next visa, which you probably wouldn't think is very important, is actually very important to the United States economy as a whole. That's the F visa, and that is for primary, secondary, and post-secondary students. Just to give you an idea of what the scope of that category is, any given year there's over a million foreign college and university students attending classes at U.S. colleges and universities. And those folks are from many different countries, and maybe this is always a fun question to ask. Which country do you think has the most foreign students at U.S. colleges and universities?
Well, there's a question for China.
My guess is China.
I'll guess Canada, just because it's close by.
Well, both of you would not be correct. The number one provider of students to U.S. colleges and universities is Saudi Arabia.
Had no idea.
Okay.
Interesting.
That's according to 2013 data. And that might be kind of tapering off because I believe that there's less funding by the Saudi government for students to attend colleges abroad, but the number two and three are China and India. So,
I should have thought of India. That's true. Okay, so this is very important because obviously it brings students overseas to go to school and obviously do part time work and other work. Can they work on those visas? I should ask that question.
Yeah, a lot of foreign students work either on campus through work study. So just again to back up, foreign students are not eligible for student aid in the United States, so they have to pay their way through. And part of the way they may do that is they may be given some on-campus jobs, which they can do under their visa category. But as they progress through their studies, they're eligible for what's called practical training. And that practical training is usually with employers outside the school, and employers can use that for internships, if it's during school, and then every foreign student who has an F visa is given 1 year of employment authorization after they graduate, and that's called optional practical training, OPT. And I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with that classification, especially given our proximity to the Boston metro area and the prevalence of colleges there. That, at least for our clients, that proximity brings a lot of foreign students into the fold. And then from there, because OPT does not have a lot of compliance overlays, it's used as a extended job interview for the employers to see if they want to proceed with more sponsorship in different categories.
Okay. So the next one would be the J visa.
Yeah. So your J visa is for exchange visitors. There are over a dozen different categories of exchange visitor programs. And those programs, by the way, are all approved by the U.S. Department of State. And there are established programs in many of these areas already. Or employers can try to set up their own exchange program. But I think most of our clients find that that's not cost-effective to try to set up a program. It's more cost-effective to partner with an existing program. And these exist for a number of different categories, including training and internships for foreign students, so students who are not attending U.S. colleges but are attending foreign colleges and universities, au pairs, so nannies, teachers, and many employers who have seasonal businesses may be familiar with the summer work travel exchange program. So in New Hampshire, your ski areas typically have, who do participate in the program, may have many employees who are from the southern hemisphere, because that is summer vacation, the winter here in the northern hemisphere. So those folks can come for a limited period of time and work, and it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to their training or if they're going to school, their schooling. It's just during their summer, our winter, they can come and work for a limited period of time. And opposite of that is true as well. Many summer resorts in New England and in surrounding areas have summer work travel J exchange visitors from Europe and Eastern Europe working, because that's their summer vacation.
Sure, I remember when I used to go to summer camp, and there was a huge contingent from England, for example, that were counselors for the summer camp I went to. So I'm sure that was part of an example of how they would do that.
Yeah, and there's also a program for specifically for camp counselors as well. So my last trip up north in the winter, I remember seeing a bunch of folks on the ski slopes operating the lifts in the lodge that were from Chile and Argentina, which I commented on to my wife.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the next visa, and we've talked about, as you said, the alphabet soup here. We've talked about the B visa, the F visa, the J visa. Now we're going to talk about the H visa, and there's a bunch of this having to do with different types of H visas, correct?
Yeah, the H is probably the visa that most employers have heard about, at least, because it has been in the news on an annual basis for the last 20 years or so. That classification was created in 1990, and there are two manifestations of it. One's an H-1B. That's a specialty occupation worker, specialty occupation being in quotes. And then there's also the H-2A and H-2B, which are temporary workers in agricultural and non-agricultural jobs. So the H-1B, the specialty occupation, those are the high-tech visas that your engineers and your folks who require a professional degree or a bachelor's degree, I should say, need to work on a temporary basis in the United States. The reason why that classification is in the news frequently is because there's a cap on the number of visas allotted each year. And at least since 2003, that cap has been reached every single year, except for maybe 1 or 2 years during the recession, and it creates a shortage. So the cap is 65,000 visas, and that's nationwide each year, plus another 20 for master's degree graduates who need visas. So 85,000 total visas per year for the entire country for specialty occupation workers.
That number has not changed, right, since it was first introduced? It's not like it's staggered or anything. It's just a flat rate.
Yeah, well, it was 65,000 through 1998, and then it went up to 200,000 for some years between 1998 and 2003. And then since 2003, it's been at the 85,000 amount. And the reason why it went up in the late 90s, early 2000s, is because Congress passed two laws, at that time, which said we need more skilled workers. Employers are demanding more skilled workers, and there's not enough visas available, so we're going to increase the amounts in these particular years. And so that ended in 2003. So because the H-1B category is oversubscribed each year, in many years, including the last 4 years, there's been a lottery to select who's going to actually get which employers are actually going to get a visa.
Wow, I didn't realize it got to that point.
Talk about business planning, huh?
Yes.
It's like the lottery.
Well, it's unfortunate because every April 1st, there are about 230, I think this last year there were 240,000 petitions filed with the Immigration Service for the 85,000 available slots. And to be fair, the Immigration Service says, okay, we'll put everyone in a bucket, electronic bucket, and we'll select winners, and the winners get their employees that they need, and the losers
don't
have to figure out something else.
Right? Yeah, they don't. That's a real challenge for employees to plan, prepare, to not know. That is a real challenge.
How do you budget for that?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, frequently our employers are thinking about this
years in advance, I would think.
Yeah, for a year or two in advance. And if their employee is not selected in the first lottery, perhaps they're participating in multiple years' lotteries for that employee who's obviously worth the investment in time and energy. And so the H-1B frequently dovetails into the F-OPT, which I mentioned before. And the reason is that the students get their OPT when they graduate in May, and they get it through the following June or July. Employers need to make H-1B hiring decisions by January or February, so they usually have a number of months to test out these folks. They file in April for the H-1Bs, and then the H-1B actually is allotted every fiscal year, so October 1st, that's the federal fiscal year. And so they're really talking about a year or a year and a half in advance for the H-1B decisions.
So is there a cost to file on a general basis, and does each one of these visas, as we're obviously talking about employment immigration here in the United States with Nathan Warwicki from Sheehan Finney, a business immigration attorney, we're talking about, is there a cost to file? And if you don't get selected to the lottery, obviously I doubt very highly they give you your money back.
Actually, the costs for an H-1B are between $1,500 and $2,000 for each petition. But those fees are returned if you're not selected in the lottery.
Wow, there's a surprise.
There's a break.
But you don't get, you don't usually get your attorney's fees back.
Yeah. No, of course not. Is that breaking news here on the HR Power Hour? No, just a joke, ladies and gentlemen, just a joke. So from that perspective, obviously, and is that the average cost for all the different type of visas? Is that an average cost across the board?
No, it does change depending on the visa category. The first three we talked about, the B, the F, the J, none of those have any cost to the employer to use in terms of filing fees or anything like that. The J, both for F visas, the school is actually the entity responsible for making sure the student is in compliance. So the employer has very minimal interaction with that. With the J, if you're establishing your own program, there is a cost associated with starting that up. But if you're associating with an existing program, usually there's a fee charged by the existing program to participate. But that varies depending on what the program is. And then for the H-1B and a few others we're going to talk about, there's a petition cost, and that can really range from $325 for an O or an E, which we'll talk about. but it can also go up to, if you're an H-1B dependent employer, the fee can be $6,000 per petition. And an H-1B dependency is if you have more than 50 employees and more than 50% of those employees are foreign nationals on H or L visas, there's an extra fee that's tacked on. And that was just added actually in December of 2015 as part of the appropriations bill. It was a lesser amount, but it was increased to $4,000.
We're going to talk about those in just a few minutes when we get back from this very important commercial break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and on WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Running a a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
This is an alert. If your business or church is building this year, you're about to pay more than you should. This could mean thousands of dollars more for your office, retail space, church, or warehouse. A General Steel building can save you as much as half the cost and time of similar conventional construction. And we're offering rebates of up to $20,000 to help you build today. Call General Steel for free information that could save you thousands. Call 800-98-STEEL. 800-98-STEEL. That's 800-987-8335.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick. I drive 200 miles an hour for a living, so it makes sense that I have life insurance. But so many people don't. That's just an unnecessary risk. It means leaving your loved ones to suffer financially if something happens to you. It's a struggle my family knows. As teenagers, both my parents lost their fathers. Neither had life insurance. Don't take that risk. Get life insurance. For help, go to lifehappens.org.
A public service message from the nonprofit Life Happens.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today, David Stearns and I are your hosts today, and we're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He is a business immigration attorney with Sheehan Finney, a great sponsor of the HR Power Hour. You know, Nathan, we've been talking about employment immigration here and the alphabet soup of choices that individuals, companies have bringing people into the United States in terms of the visas. And so we've kind of talked about, and I'll go down the list because I think it's important, the B, the F, the J, and we're in the middle of the H. We talked about the H-1B, which is a pretty common one that is used and it's been in the news a lot. Talk a little bit about the H-2A and H-2B and why those are important to businesses today.
Sure. Well, the H-2A is a visa that in New England is not used a lot because there's not a lot of agriculture, but in the Midwest, in the South, and in some particular industries in New England, at least like dairy farmers, for instance, the H-2A is used to augment U.S. workforces to, you know, go out and milk cows or pick fields and that sort of thing. And there's some pretty stringent oversight that comes along with having an H-2A employee by the state and federal employment authorities. And the crux of that is that the costs associated with getting these visas are very high. And so in some cases, it makes the employment of folks in those categories prohibitive because, again, there are those added costs associated with the H-2A. There's some stories of some dairy farmers in Vermont who recently were talking about this with some news outlets and how they couldn't afford to hire college kids, A, because they didn't want to milk cows during their summer, and B, because they couldn't afford to comply with the H-2A program costs, not just the wages, but also the costs.
Right, the costs for the program, yeah.
Yeah.
How about the H-2B?
So the H-2B, that also has a cap, much like the H-1B, and that's $66,000 each year. The H-1B is for folks who are in specialty occupations, so I mean they have to usually have at least a bachelor's degree. The H-2B is for anyone, really, so there's no degree or real training requirement. But the need of the employer in the H-2B context is what is paramount. The need must be temporary, and that's defined as either one-time, seasonal, peak load, or intermittent. So usually that's less than a year. And you may find H-2Bs working at resorts along with the J employees because those are seasonal businesses. And that's something that in New England our employers frequently need, the seasonal employees. You may also find H-2Bs working in landscaping because that's also seasonal, or in other industries where the employer's demand fluctuates heavily over the course of the year.
Sure.
And so that actually leads me into the labor certification aspect of all these visas. Some visas do require that there be a labor market test, and that's the H-2B in this case. The H-2B labor certification requires the employer to list the job before they ever bring in a foreign national to fill it, list the job with local unemployment agencies, list the job in help wanted sections of newspapers, and comply with some other posting requirements. And the aim of that is to test the U.S. labor market to make sure there are no U.S. workers that can fill these positions before it's offered to a foreign national. So that's part of the H-2B program. It's also part of the immigrant visa, the permanent residence process for some of your lower priority workers. There's a labor certification requirement in those cases as well.
So now we have the L, which is we're finally about the midway through the alphabet. So what's the L visa?
The L is for intra-company transferees, and that is a employee who is transferring from a foreign company to a related American company. And that relationship has to be a corporate relationship usually. So a parent or a subsidiary or maybe sister companies all operating within the same group. That is used if the L is not available for all your employees. So you can't just transfer an entire office from France to the United States using the L visa. It's specifically for employees who are executives or managers, and that means folks who have the titles of CEO and CFO and those types of folks, but it also can mean someone who is managing a essential function of the organization. So that could mean your marketing director, your director of sales, your production manager, those types of folks who are managing other people and managing other people either in one particular segment of the company or company-wide. So the example I can think of is if you have a marketing director in your European subsidiary, but they have responsibility for marketing not only in Europe but also the United States, and they direct a marketing team that includes people both in the United States and in Europe, then they might qualify under that particular segment of the L visa.
Sure.
The other one is a specialized knowledge worker. The specialized knowledge is a interesting test which has developed over the last 26 years, but right now it's for folks who have advanced or special knowledge of either a industry-specific skill or equipment or something along those lines, or they're so familiar with the company's processes or products that they're essential in that way.
So is there any other part of the L that employers need to know about?
Yes. When you're transferring somebody, that person has to be an existing employee. So you can't make a hire from abroad and expect them to transfer to the United States immediately. There's a one-year employment requirement in those cases, and you know that can create some challenges for employers who want someone to kind of take the reins right away in the United States but can't because of that one-year requirement. And in those situations, typically someone might come to the United States using the B for very limited periods to consult with their American counterparts. But then once that year is up and they have that under their belt, then they could transfer to the L. And that requires some planning from the employer's perspective, but it's certainly doable.
Sure, sure. What's the next visa we should be aware of?
Well, I want to talk to you about the non-immigrant visa classifications that are results of U.S. treaties with foreign countries. And the most voluminous of those is the E visa, and those are for treaty traders and investors. The United States has treaties of commerce and friendship, bilateral investment treaties, and some other commercial treaties with over 100 different countries in the world, and each of those trees has this e-visa status as part of it. So it's available to two segments. One is for international traders, so not Benedict Arnold traders, but Adam Smith traders.
Okay, nice.
And that's those folks who are importing goods to the United States or exporting goods from the United States to the foreign country. The other component is the investors, so folks who are investing money from abroad into the United States in commercial enterprises. And that can be an investment that is, there's no dollar value associated with that. It can be an investment in a few Domino's franchises, for instance, and that can qualify in certain situations, or it can be an investment in a new manufacturing facility that requires hundreds of millions of dollars in startup capital. There's a wide array of different investments that might qualify.
We're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He is with Sheehan Finney. He's a business immigration attorney. We're talking about immigration employment, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Like the taste of fresh apples? Looking for something a little different? Try an Angry Orchard hard cider. We use traditional cider apples from a 100-year-old orchard. It takes two apples to make each bottle of Angry Orchard. So at the end of the day, relax and raise a glass to something a little unexpected. Angry Orchard. Crisp, refreshing, and not too sweet. And now, in cans. Angry Orchard hard cider. Branch out.
Angry Orchard Cider Company. Walden, New York. Drink responsibly.
At 154 years old, Veral Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Veral Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Veral Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at veraldana.com.
Join the Northeast Human Resource Association at their annual conference from September 28th through 30th in Falmouth, Massachusetts. See why the NERA conference is sure to be 2.5 days of HR education you won't want to miss. With awesome keynotes, you'll be sure to leave Falmouth with new resources and key knowledge to support you in your career and earn up to 15.5 SHRM and HRCI credits. Register now at nehra.com or by calling 781-235-2900.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today, your host, David Chulo, and guest host, David Stearns, are talking with Nathan Warwicki. He is a business immigration attorney for Sheehan Finney, and we are talking about employment immigration. That's what we're talking about today. And, you know, we've been going through the alphabet soup here, Nathan, of all the different types of visas. And we're going to finish this show today, our first segment, continuing and talking about treating non-immigrants. So let's talk a little bit and wrap that up a little bit.
Sure. Well, we just talked about the two types of e-visas, the traders and the investors. One point I wanted to make was that the nationality of the trader or the investor is very important because those treaties those classifications are based on treaties between two countries. So, for instance, if you're a German company and you want to bring someone to the United States to help move goods from Germany to the United States and you want to use this e-visa classification, the nationality of the trader, which can be either a person or an employee of an entity, is very important. So trying to match those up is subject to some very special rules which relate to who owns the company and who's the ultimate owner if there are intermediate corporations, which can be very complicated.
I was going to say that certainly can be pretty complicated. So it's not just about bringing the person in with the skill set. It's also about, you know, so who owns the company and what nationality they are as well.
Right, and each of those determinations is very fact-specific. So usually employers who have this on their radar are trying to figure out that particular part of it. And, you know, usually when I work with employers on this, they discover something about their own company they didn't even know. So,
no, I'm sure they have. Yeah. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about today employment immigration. We've talked about some of the historical roots. We've talked about some of the current state of the law today. We've talked a little bit about temporary versus permanent immigration with green cards versus visas. And we've, of course, done the alphabet soup, as I like to call it, of a number of the visa classifications from B to F to J to H, from H2A and H2B, L, and treating non-immigrants, E1 and E2. But we're not done, and we're going to do that on the next show. So, Nathan, I'm very excited to have you coming back next Saturday to finish up talking about employment immigration. I appreciate you being on the show today and Shea Infinity being a great sponsor. Thank you, and we look forward to talking with you next week.
Thanks, Dave.
And now your HR tip of the week. Your HR tip of the week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Elizabeth Kennellan-Smith with VeralDana. The September 30 deadline for filing EEO-1 forms is fast approaching, so this is a reminder to audit your workplace and update your equal employment opportunity policies, especially if your workplace is one subject to affirmative action law. Employers with 50 or more employees and $50,000 or more in federal contract funds in any given year are required to maintain an affirmative action plan and to file Form EEO-1 each year. Since many companies value diversity in the workforce, you could gain a competitive edge by auditing your workforce with a goal of increasing diversity, regardless of whether your company is required to maintain an affirmative action program. Studies show that diverse workplaces foster innovation, so recruiting and retention, with an eye towards both inherent and acquired diversity, will result in a stronger workforce and greater market growth. For more information, contact VeralDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is going to be Nathan Warwicki. He is an employment attorney with Shea Infinity, and we're going to be doing the second half of our series having to do with immigration employment. It's a great topic. It's alphabet soup. Come learn more on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.